Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Steve in the home port for AGLCA, and we also have from our home port crew, Roger Daines is on here and Janice is on here. Beth is still on vacation, so we'll talk to her next week.
I think Beth will be on. She decided to work today.
Well, she hasn't called in.
Okay.
And our guest again this week is Mark Coles from Boating Georgian Bay. I don't know if you've heard the last show he did was, 3 weeks ago? But we got through a bunch of questions that people always have about Georgian Bay, and we're just going to pick it up this week with where we left off. So I guess I'm just going to launch into this. If anybody has questions, you can call us on a toll-free on 1-877-497-1815. So, Mark, you and I had a little debate about where we left off the last time, so if we're covering the same ground twice, people just have to put up with it. But the question that we think we left off with the last time was about the weather in Georgian Bay turning from calm to ugly in a hurry. Can you address that? What's the best way to keep up with that?
Yeah. Well, you know, in the summertime when the loopers would be up in Georgian Bay, you know, you get these thermal updrafts, you know, from the heat and the water, similar to what you see down south. And so it can blow up. And I remember you asked me the question about, you know, does it come up in the afternoon and what happens? Quite often the wind comes up in the afternoon, but, you know, you can't kind of count on that. I mean, you can be dead still and wake up in the middle of the night and things will be blowing, right, and vice versa. So what I recommend is the weather can come up very quickly in Georgian Bay. You know, you want to – not every anchorage is totally sheltered from all directions. Our storm winds tend to come in from the east, but, you know, you just – in the summertime they come in from the east. You just never know for sure. And your best bet is to pay close attention to the, you know, to the like weather radar, like the NOAA weather radar is really good. I actually prefer that. I look at the Environment Canada weather. I look at the NOAA weather, and I kind of put two and two together. On the website, you can take a link there to the NOAA weather radar right from the weather button on the website, as well as all the Canadian weather and the port weather and the buoy weather are all on the same page. So it's kind of like a page you can go to if you're online, you know, while you're traveling. You can go to that and just from one page get access to kind of all the weather information that you need. And that combined to, you know, listening to the MAFOR codes and the current, you know, weather report on 21B or WX4, you can basically put, you know, one and one together and get a good answer. When I find conflicts between the Environment Canada weather and the NOAA weather for Georgian Bay, I favor the NOAA. I'm just telling you the truth, what I do. I favor the NOAA weather side, and I just find that they seem to be more often on the mark than not. So, and you will see conflicts there, and that's why I like to look at, you know, several different sources of weather and not just kind of one to make up my mind. And I always check it, you know, before I go to bed at night, and I always, you know, check it in the morning. And I want to tell you an interesting story that just happened the other day, because we had 2 days of sunny, windy weather, day and night, that gusting up to, you know, like 70-mile-an-hour winds, and the forecast was actually for 15. And the boat beside me in the marina that I'm at was out at anchor the night before last, and at about 1 in the morning, drag anchor and was right into the rocks all night long from 1:30 on. In this completely sheltered anchorage, it was just such a hard blow, and he had 100 feet of chain down, and you know, he didn't just have enough chain down, I guess. But in any event, that's what can happen. So you want to be, you know, very careful about, you know, kind of understanding from different sources what to expect with the weather.
Okay, earlier in answering this question, you were referring to a website. I presume that's your website, which is www.boatinggeorgianbay.com. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. If you look in the upper right hand corner of BoatingGeorgianBay.com, there's a big button there. It says weather. Click here. It looks like a compass rose. And if you
okay.
click on there, it has all the port weather all around the bay and individual ports. It has the Environment Canada weather, the buoy weather out in the bay itself, the monitoring system on the buoys, and then access to all the NOAA weather radar information as well.
And then you also referred to BAFOR codes.
The MAFOR codes, yes.
MAFOR, there you go.
MAFOR codes are actually on that page as well at the bottom. And if you want to, you can print that off and keep those handy. You know, I listen to the MAFOR codes maybe, you know, once in the morning type thing but I find that, you know, by jumping around between different sources is a much surer way of, let's put it this way, if you're in Georgian Bay and you're going to go up, you know, you're running up the northeast side and you get, you know, you're getting some really strong, you know, winds coming in from the west, and you're traveling in the small craft channel in sections that could be exposed, in other words, outside, because a lot of the channel is completely inside and protected, and there's sections that are kind of like totally exposed to the bay, like between Port of Barrel and Britt. And you want to be sure that before you get out there that you know what you're getting into weather-wise, because it's hard to, until you get there and see it, it's almost like you're kind of looking off into the horizon and seeing maybe little bits of rock out in the middle of a bay that's just looks like the ocean, right? And then looking in towards land, you know, the land's like almost out of sight, and again you're seeing little bits of rocks and stuff, and you're actually in a channel, you know, it's like an offshore channel, right?
Yep.
And so if you're I mean, the two things that can happen that are dangerous in a situation like that, one is heavy winds, because you know, these waves come in and drag over all those rock shelves and break right across the channel. And I think I mentioned before, you know, we call that the washing machine effect, you know, where things are going every which way. Channels are relatively narrow. And if you've got a big boat in one of those channels exposed like that, it's a fairly, you know, high-risk scenario. And the other thing that can happen that I think we touched on last time as well is fog. And if you which typically happens on a real kind of still day, but not, you know, there can be a light winds or whatever that blow it in off the bay, and it can happen, you know, at times that you wouldn't expect it to happen at. Like, you know, you think, well, you're always going to see fog in the morning first thing. Well, gosh, I mean, I've seen it roll in at, you know, have a beautiful clear day and roll in at 10, 11 o'clock.
Yeah.
And you know, where you can't see your hand in front of your face. So but all those things are kind of typically forecast ahead if you're checking different sources. So the thing is just when you're in terms of anchoring at night and in terms of traveling where you may be exposed to the bigger part of the bay, it's just prudent to you know, to make sure that you know what to expect that day or that night.
Yep. I'm going to go back to the MAFOR codes again.
Yep.
To my knowledge, we don't use those in the United States. The first time I ever saw that was when I was in Georgian Bay. So maybe you could explain to the folks a little bit more about what they are and how they work and how they get them.
Well, the MAFOR codes are broadcast daily on the Weather Channel. And, you know, basically what the MAFOR codes are, it's just a coding system. You would listen to the broadcast and you would write these codes down, you know, as you listen to it. And then, you know, when you do it enough, you just get used to it and you know kind of what they're saying by code. But you write the codes down in order that they give them for your area, and then you look at them later against the code chart, and you can kind of see what they're predicting in terms of the period of the forecast and the wind direction and the you know, the force in knots, and then also the visibility in terms of fog or drizzle or whatever, right?
Okay.
So, you know, I kind of listen to them once and, you know, kind of take stock of them. Most of that, you know, if you listen to the regular weather forecasts, what I advise you not to do is just listen to the radio Environment Canada weather only, and then just like marine weather forecast only, and then just kind of forget about it for the rest of the day. You know, I would be monitoring your radio from time to time as well, but I would also, you know, take a good look around in terms of the buoy weather and you know, the port weather to where you're going and where you're leaving from. And I would also, you know, for sure look at the weather radar. The funny thing is, you know, in Georgian Bay, it's really another great lake. You know, we refer to it as a bay, but it's a huge, huge area. And, you know, the weather can be completely different, you know, further north than in the south or whatever. And, and you know, if you're traveling, you know, along the there's almost like a what I find all the time, there's almost like a midway point about halfway up the, you know, when you get into the Portobello area, by example, there almost seems to be like a breaking point there in the weather where you're often find even winds going in different directions completely. So you can have the wind coming from the west down to the south and, you know, coming across from the, you know, from the east or the northeast, you know, to the north, you know, completely different in the same bay, right?
Yep.
And if you're traveling offshore, like most people are going to want to go on the, you know, for the scenery, they're going to want to go on the, you know, the inland small craft route, mostly inland small craft route. But, you know, there may be times where, you know, you'll go outside, or there may be some boats that, you know, just want to kind of, you know, make bigger jumps and spend more time, you know, in the North Channel up at the Benjamins or something like that. And, you know, they may go from you know, Midland to Parry Sound, or, you know, outside, or go from Midland even to, you know, to Britt or to Killarney outside. And, you know, they're going to miss a lot of beautiful scenery, and they're going to miss most of the 30,000 islands. But there are folks that do that, and, you know, then they spend more time, you know, up in the North Channel area. Again, if you're offshore like that and you're traveling, you know, at a faster speed, like if you're a planing boat or something and you're doing 20 knots, you're going to see, you know, notice bigger changes in the weather, you know, between the north and the south, typically.
Yeah.
Mark, I've had several people ask me about gray water and sewage in the Canadian waterways. Can you address that?
Yes. Gray water, sink water, shower water, you can discharge. And obviously, you know, if you're in a tight anchorage or something and you have a gray water holding system, you know, it would be nice to wait to not discharge it all at once. In a, you know, most boats kind of discharge gray water routinely, you know, from shower and sinks. And but if you're, you know, in terms of your sewage, your holding tank, you can't, of course, discharge that anywhere. And also, you know, you have to clearly have a separation. If you have an overboard discharge system, as many offshore cruisers would have, you'd have a total disconnect, not just the valve disconnect at the Y, but you need a total disconnect, permanent disconnect on the piping from the discharge to the tank. If you do get inspected, that's what they'd be looking for, a complete disconnect. It's not acceptable just to have, you know, the Y valve closed and or even locked or whatever. You got to have the pipe disconnected, and no sewage discharge at all allowed. Gray water, yes.
That's a question that comes up once a week with our folks, so it's good to have a clear answer to that.
Yeah, it's I know it's an inconvenience, you know, to you know, cruisers that are, you know, are kind of world travelers and used to, you know, traveling offshore and things like that. But the problem, I guess, is that if everybody just had a Y valve and they could just kind of flip it over, the temptation might be there for some boaters that they, you know, that they wouldn't get pump outs, that they just, you know, discharge it, which we don't want. So the nice thing is, I think one of the things you're going to ask me later about is about pump outs and stuff. But, you know, pretty much all of your ports of call, you know, every marina, pretty much, not every marina, but you're always going to find, you know, pump outs available. It's not like you'll be, you know, they're hard to find or anything like that. I know that they're probably a little more expensive up here than they would be, you know, in a lot of places. And part of that is when you're traveling in the 30,000 islands, you know, anything that's island-based or any of the island-based stops or marinas or anything like that, or even on the mainland, you know, you're pretty much in the middle of nowhere or further away. And so unless it's one of the main ports, you know, it's going to be, you know, probably a little higher cost, maybe $40 type thing. You know, I can't tell you what they all are, but a little higher cost because, you know, they got to get rid of this stuff, right? It's not, especially if you're on an island, it gets expensive, as does fuel. You know, if you're buying fuel on an island, at a, you know, at a marina on an island, and they have to, you know, bring it in by barge, you know, you're going to pay more than if it's than if it's mainland, right?
Yep. And is there any long stretches without fuel available?
No, you'll never have a problem. There's enough ports along the way. You know, some of the ports are not, you know, they're towns. Like, you know, there's bigger towns like, you know, Parry Sound by example. Like Midland's a small city, and Penetang and right beside it. And you know, Parry Sound, as you go north on the east side, you know, a bigger town. But in between, there's marinas and smaller ports, and they all have fuel and they all have pump out. So you won't have any problem at all, you know, going up the east side, even if you were going a different route and going around to the south or over to Tobermory and up, you wouldn't have any problem at all, you know, getting that service at all. You've got to plan a little bit. Like, you don't want to just, you know, if you're anchoring out in one location for a week or something and then taking another, you know, 4 days somewhere else before you got, but you could get day-to-day, you know, anywhere and easily and get fuel or pump out.
Okay, great. What about tow services? If I break down or, God forbid, hit a rock and need a tow?
Yeah, there's a section on the website called Boating Emergencies where there's information on there. Of course, the Coast Guard's here, and, you know, there are actual recovery services as well. Coast Guard, you know, monitoring 16 or star 16 on your cell phone. If you have a real emergency, you can contact the Coast Guard. There's also the Ontario Boating League, which is a private organization servicing Southern Georgian Bay, and you know, they're really good at getting out there too. And the Coast Guard will actually patch you through to them as well if you have something that's like, you know, a mechanical problem or a less serious emergency. But it'd be a good idea if you go on the website. There's a page there, and you can print that off and have it somewhere handy. It's got your emergency contact information. The Ontario Boating League, you know, they have several boats and you know, one with the winch. They'll tow your boat in. They'll you know, get your boat running again if something's wrong, or, you know, they'll do emergency work as well. Usually if there's something, you know, the Coast Guard's heading to that's an emergency, if it's down in their area, they'd probably be heading to it as well just to see if they can help, you know. And you can become a member there. I believe it's $60 a season, but you don't have to be a member. It's not like they'll ignore you or they won't help you if you're not a member. They still will, but you'll pay them, you know, for the service when you need it type thing. You know, for somebody that's up there all the time, I think it's like insurance, right? You just have it.
Yep.
The Coast Guard, of course, will respond to all emergencies, and you'll see them around here and there at various ports. You know, you might see some of the you know, the bigger Coast Guard ships that are out there, you know, checking the buoys and stuff like that. But you know, they're around, and they have access to search and rescue from Trenton, and they have access to you know, the high speed boats that. In that area, you know, they can pretty much get to you in a hurry if they know where you are, or if you know where you are. Type. It's always a good thing, though. Probably most of your loopers now would certainly, that they'd have the radio locators probably, and you know, or if not, you know, they'd have an EPIRB with the GPS in it, right? That they can kind of pinpoint you exactly. And if you got into a real serious trouble, and there's a lot of traffic in general, like, you'd be surprised, you know, even in rough weather, there's always somebody out there, right? There's always other boats out there, and there's bigger boats, and there's even ships out there right out in the bay. So, you know, there's always somebody out there, but, you know, you still have to be careful because it is a very rocky kind of treacherous bay if you're not paying attention to where you are. I think we talked a little bit earlier. If you don't know where you are exactly, and I mean exactly, it's time to stop and figure out where you are. You don't want to keep going, sight alone type thing.
Yeah. What are the good places to resupply?
Well, the towns are the main places that people kind of universally go into would be Midland. Midland Penetang are kind of like side by side on southern Georgian Bay, and they're not far from where you come in off the Trent into the bay. So people usually go in there and provision, and, you know, there's marine supply stores and, you know, everything you can imagine. They're you know, it's a decent-sized city type thing. And then, you know, the next one up, there's lots of places in between that you could also resupply, you know, that would have, you know, groceries and basic stuff like that. But the next one up where you'd be into like a city kind of thing would be Parry Sound. And again, you know, everything's walking distance, you know, right from where you would dock there. And then once you get into the channel in the north, I mean, the little current, you know, is a smaller town, but kind of geared up for people stopping to resupply. But that's not to say that you can't get, I mean, you know, all the way up, if you need something, you're going to be able to get in and get it, like, you know, Honey Harbor. And then, you know, Parry Sound, and then, Porto Barro, certainly Britt. Britt's a popular place to go in. It's a kind of the logical jumping-off point before you get to Killarney, and then Killarney's kind of like the beginning of the North Channel. So there's all these towns and marinas and places along the way everywhere that if you need to get in to get something, you know, you can do that.
Okay, great.
Let's talk. You're not going to find, like, a West Marine or something, you know, at all these towns. You will in Midland, but you're not going to find, like, a big, you know, kind of like a box store marine stuff all the way along the way. But all of the marinas also carry, you know, a lot of parts and general supplies and stuff like that. They're just not going to have, you know, everything that a box store would have.
Okay. Let's talk about anchoring for a little bit. I guess the first question is, how sheltered are most of the anchorages up there?
Well, the best way to decide on your anchorage is to figure out how far you want to go that day, and then kind of obviously look at your charts and see what's in the area. We have a section on the website called favorite anchorages, which are kind of like the popular anchorages that you know are along the way. But there's so many anchorages. They're just everywhere, and it depends on, you know, whether you want privacy or whether you want to be where there's other boats around or what degree of shelter you're looking for depending on the weather that's coming. There's typically anchorages that you can find, you know, every night all along the way that are 100% sheltered. In other words, you're surrounded by, you know, by land type thing. And also, but there's some very nice anchorages that are not sheltered from every direction that are completely safe. You know, that you'll be in too, depending on the wind direction, on the forecast, and the nature of the weather. In terms of bottom conditions, that can vary a lot. Like you'll see, you know, when you're down, like if you were down around, you know, out towards the bay in the, you know, Penetang area, like Christian Island, all that very sandy. You do see some sand in other places along the way too. But more commonly, you know, when you're going up the East Coast, you'll see bottom will be mud, typically with clay below it, and which is very good holding. You know, and you know, if you get into the clay, it's a little harder to set, but great holding, you know, when you're into it. And, you know, you might have, you know, mud on top, and then below it you'll have clay. You'll also get into anchorages where it's scoured rock. And that's the tough stuff, because, you know, if you're just kind of dragging along on rock, you know, you're not going to be a friendly anchor. That's a lot of those places you'll see people spidered in, or, you know, multiple anchors and stuff like that. But there are some anchorages, not too many, but there are some anchorages where it's just like scoured bedrock down there. And then, of course, there are some anchorages, by example, the pool, which is hugely popular. You know, if you're going down like Bay Finn and into the pool, and people kind of hike up to Topaz Lake and stuff like that, it's a very popular destination as you go north. It's very weedy, and you'll find there's other anchorages like that too, where it's a little hard to set because the weeds are so dense at the bottom that you've got to, you know, be careful that you get a really good set, that you get in through the weeds type thing. And then the other thing to keep an eye on Georgian Bay, the area, you know, back, you know, decades ago, was you know, was there was a lot of logging operations and mills and stuff along the bay, And a lot of the same places that are anchorages, because they're sheltered, were also locations where there was, in the past, there was mills running. And, of course, anywhere there was a mill running, you know, you're going to have a lot of debris and logs and stuff at the bottom, you know, deadheads and stuff that have gone to the bottom. So most of that information, you know, is available. It's in the guidebooks. It's on the, you know, it's on, you know, it's kind of like well known. But you might want to have a trip line on your anchor. Like, you're probably, most of your folks are used to using it anyhow. And it's always a good idea. You never know, you know, when you might get hooked onto a log or something where it just won't come up, you know. And it's never a bad idea to have a trip line. Most anchorages, you won't have a problem with that, but there are, you know, a few that have a lot of debris at the bottom like that. And the other thing is that I should say is, you know, a lot of the anchorages are clear enough that you can see the bottom, you know, and, you know, as long as you're, you know, not in too deep of water, you can see the bottom. And if you're anchoring along rock walls and stuff like that, you're more liable to find that, you know, you're into scoured rock. So you might, you know, you'll probably be tied into shore a couple ways, and you may have an anchor out as well holding you off, you know, if you plan to be around for a few days and one anchorage. I mean, some of these boats get really, really spidered in kind of thing, so with multiple lines, so they're not going anywhere type thing. But it's not something that you want to look for to do if you're just there overnight, because it's a lot of work to have lines strung around every which way. But you know, you just have to be careful to look at the bottom conditions. You can, if you're snorkeling, the water's warm in the summer. It's you know, it's, you know, 78 degrees around there. In the anchorage, even more. You can, you know, put on the snorkel gear and typically, you know, take a look down and look at your set and stuff if you want to do that. You know, but you won't have any problems. You know, if you get a good set and you feel that you've got a good set and you're well sheltered, and most of them are. Most anchorages are well sheltered, and you know what direction the wind is going to be, you know, coming from overnight. Then you won't have any problems.
Good. What are your favorite ports in Georgian Bay?
Well, there's so many. There's a list on the website, and you might want to take a look at that. A lot of it depends on what you want to do. If you wanted to get into some bigger towns, you know, most people are into Midland or Penetang. Along the way, and you know, there's lots and lots of stuff to do there. You know, most people are, you know, Honey Harbor is a nice spot. You know, you've got a sponsor there, both in Midland and Penetang. You've got the Parkridge Group, which has a number of marinas in the Midland Penetang area, Bay Moorings and Bayport, and as well you have. South Bay Cove at Honey Harbor, which is a nice marina. And then as you go north into Britt, you've got Wright's Marina, which is a sponsor that's there. And, you know, the folks that are marinas that are sponsors, I mean, they're sponsors because they want to help, and you know, they understand the importance and, you know, kind of what loopers are doing it for. And so they're very responsive to that. But there's, you know, there's a lot of marinas. In Georgian Bay total, you know, I think we added it up one time. There's like 100,000 slips altogether in all marinas, all locations in Georgian Bay total. So,
wow.
As far as, you know, favorite ports to stop along the way, you know, most people want to, you know, they would go into Midland or Penetang, maybe both. They go into Honey Harbor, maybe. They go to, most people want to stop at Henry's, which is the restaurant on the island off of Parry Sound.
Yep.
You know, most people would be stopping in Parry Sound. Probably they would go into Britt, into Bing Inlet. They might go into Port of Barrow as well, which they come through along the way, which is a very pretty area. Killarney is a must stop, and it's a logical spot that, you know, from Britt that you would go to the next day before you head into the North Channel. And then, you know, in the North Channel, like Little Current and Gore Bay and Blind River, if you go on the site, there's actually a port section, and there's a map of all the ports. And if you click on the individual ports of call, there's actually even street maps for that area, and they'll give you a good sense of the size of the town. In the North Channel, there are a few of the town or a few of the areas that you would dock at where it's a bit of a walk into the town. But usually, you know, you're right there, and you know, all these towns have, you know, the basics to resupply, and sometimes more than the basics. and they all have, you know, marina facilities and fuel and pump out. And, you know, it's an interesting thing. Like, you know, I know a lot of your folks will really be focused on anchoring out all the time, but, you know, there's some other, you know, real interest in visiting some of these towns. There's a lot of history in the area and a lot of architectural interest, and, you know, a lot of, like, people go to Britt for the pickerel, and they go to Killarney, you know, for the pickerel as well, and just kind of the, you know, the ambience there. And it's worthwhile at least stopping at some of these ports along the way to, you know, to visit and you know, kind of see what's going on in the area, in the towns. And there's a lot of attractions and stuff focused around the towns as well. Certainly, you could spend a week in Midland and you know, visit Martyr's Shrine and you know, there's lots of different things you know, going on there that you would that you might want to see.
Okay, great.
What, Mark,
as well, I might add that there is an events page on the site, and you know, if you happen to coincide in a port with an event, that can be fun too. There's quite a few events along the bay that are planned in the various ports for the summer, and you know, you'd have a lot of fun involving yourself in those things as well.
Right.
For example, you know,
how easy is it to get from your anchorage to the shore? I mean, is there a place to leave your dinghy in most towns?
Yeah, if you're on a park island, there's designated spots that you can land where there's typically some docking as well, and you know, you can land and go ashore there. You know, if you're anchored somewhere, excuse me, remotely, you know, you might be a ways away in a dinghy ride to the nearest town and all that, but it's all doable. Things aren't that far apart that you couldn't anchor your boat somewhere and then head off in the dinghy, you know, to a town anywhere, or you know, just if you were, you know, going ashore or something, you know, it's not hard. There's usually the common places that you would anchor. You'll also see other dinghies, you know, where they're going ashore. The only thing you have to be careful of course, is, you know, cottages and things like that on private land. You don't want to go and disturb their I mean, they may be happy to see you, or they may come out and talk to you, but some of them may not be, you know, if they're there for peace and quiet and they don't want to see anybody around. So you try to anchor away from a cottage or whatever, and there's usually somewhere where you can get to shore, and you'll see other boats, you know, kind of going there as well. And you just want to be careful that you're not, you know, trespassing on somebody's private land.
Thank you.
I think that also answered my next question, which was about the etiquette between cruises and cottagers. So,
yeah, there's a couple more things I might mention there. Now, if you go on the website, I believe it's the bottom of the homepage, there's actually the boaters and the cottagers up there collectively have drafted up kind of a, you know, an etiquette manifesto or whatever you can call it that. But common sense things like, you know, you know, you don't go ashore to somebody's cottage and start, you know, walking around looking in the windows and things like that. And, you know, you don't, you know, you try to run your generator at times that won't disturb other people. You know, if you're a very large yacht and your generator is running all the time, then you try to find somewhere, you know, where you're not going to be, you know, keeping people awake at night. Fires and things like that, like you want to make sure that, you know, you're not building a fire on somebody's private land or building a fire in somewhere that's undesignated, you know, along a park anchorage, you know, wake and noise and things like that, just kind of common things. You know, it's not, you know, you're more likely to have a noise problem, by example, from local boaters than you would from anybody that's, you know, that's part of the cruising fraternity, because they understand all these things already. You know, the worst case scenario, I think the most common thing that people run into is if they've got pets on board and they maybe go ashore, you know, by a cottage or something like that for their pet, and the cottage owner, you know, takes offense to that or something. But you'll have to just, you know, be you know, a little bit cognizant. So much of the area that they'll be traveling in will be, you know, it'll look like wilderness kind of thing all the time. There's nothing there. So I don't want to give the impression that everything's built up, because it's not. It's very kind of remote looking on the way up. But you still need to pay attention when there's cottagers in the area.
Okay. Any problems getting repairs done in Georgian Bay?
Well, you know, for there is if the worst case scenario happened and you actually, you know, went aground somewhere or sank your boat or something, there are salvage services and they're on the website, and boats do get floated and then moved down to Midland or Penetang for major repair work. You know, all the marinas pretty much do general repairs and can get you parts or get parts in for you along the way, you know, prop repairs, shaft repairs. If they can't do it, you know, they'll send out for the prop service type thing. And so they can, you know, most repairs can be done along the way. If you had something major, it's possible that the boat would have to be moved, down to, like Penetang or Midland or something like that, where there's, larger facilities. Depending on the size of the boat, not every marina, as you go north, has the lift capability to take out, the bigger boats, let's say over 50 feet type thing, eh? But
okay.
They do down in Midland. I mean, they're pulling boats down in Midland, out up to kind of the 70, 80 foot range type thing.
Uh-huh.
So, but you can always get access to repairs or get problems fixed along the way. If it can't happen right where you're at, there's always a way to services to, where they can get your boat to where it can be taken care of. And most marinas do have lifts, and probably for most of your loopers for boat wise, that capability would be in the same area, in the direct area, or somewhere close that they could get to for a prop repair, shaft repair, something like that.
Okay, great. excuse me. The next question we had was sharing some tips on great restaurants. And before you do that, when I was up there, one of the most pleasant surprises I had was in Penetang. There is a Greek restaurant that has the best Greek food I ever eat. So one of these days, we're going to get back up there.
Yeah, that's the Olympia restaurant right on
yep.
the hill, at the top of the hill in Penetang.
Yep.
And you'll also find there's another really nice Greek restaurant in Midland, Reeve Bistro, if you like Greek food. And we frequent them both. And there's an interesting page on the site. It's restaurant reviews, and there's some great restaurants on there that you don't want to miss, that are serving great food. And one of the popular things along the way is the pickerel restaurants and stuff like that. Everybody wants to eat fresh pickerel, and you'll see a lot of that up through Britt, Clarney, Henry's, everywhere along the way. So go on and take a look at that restaurant review page, and it'll give you those are some of our favorite restaurants. As I mentioned, probably everybody will go into Henry's and dock there, or at least have a dinner or a lunch there type thing. That's the restaurant on the island off of Parry Sound. Probably everybody will go into Britt and have some pickerel there. South Bay Cove, which is a sponsored member, they've got a beautiful restaurant right in the marina there, which is down in Honey Harbor, not far from Midland. And, when you get up to Killarney, there's Killarney Mountain Lodge and the Sportsman Inn, and, get up to Little Current, and there's the Anchor Hotel and stuff like that. So there's lots of places that are nice places to dine along the way. In Midland, there's tons of them. I mean, you could spend a week there and go to a good restaurant every different night. But if you go on that restaurant review page, it'll give you an idea of some of the ones that we like and kind of what to expect. If they're on there, it means that we had good food and good experiences there. So,
okay, great.
Mark, I have to comment. Just about everything you've answered, there's a resource on your webpage. I think we need to tell our members, visit it if they're coming up to the North Channel or the Bay. Sounds like you've got everything they could possibly need to know.
Yeah, it's a pretty comprehensive website. I mean, the whole purpose of it was that it would be a way online to get at the most current marine information, whether it's depths, phone numbers, whatever, it's all there, and it's really kept up to date, like within, frequently up to date. And so, you can get the most current marine information. You can get information about events. You can get all the ports of call information, including street maps. You can get all the weather information. There's a lot of just kind of what's new and interesting stuff on there to read as well. And, we just try to make it a very kind of, we call it GUI, an interesting site for people who are boaters to look around, and also a resource that they can find the information they need, for cruising the bay.
Great.
Okay, good. What about shipwrecks? Are they charted?
Well, you know,
are they worth snorkeling in?
Yeah, I mean they really are. If you're into snorkeling or diving, this is an absolute mecca for shipwrecks. I mean, they're preserved in very cold water. Many or most of them are very shallow dives or even right at the surface. There's just so many of them. I don't know how many in our. There's a database on the website under the shipwreck page that you know kind of lists them all and when they went down and why they went down and stuff like that. Some are just remnants. Some are very, you know, kind of intact. And, you know, going back, you know, schooners right through to current day, a lot of, you know, steamships and stuff down there, a lot of workboats and things that went down over the years that were involved in logging and stuff like that. People have to remember, like, you know, this whole Bay Area, especially the Southern Bay, but also even up at, you know, up in the North Channel and Brit and, you know, they were, you know, and still are to some degree, I mean, major shipping going on there in terms of moving materials and people. And, you know, back in the days before even cars and roads were there, you know, people were boating into the area on steamships and stuff to get to their, to get to towns and cottages and resupply towns and stuff like that. So there's a lot of history underwater there, and the waters are very clear. And, you know, don't take anything away from the wrecks if you're diving a wreck. But there's so many that are even uncharted, and there's lots of them, big ones, and even big ones where lots of lives were lost and stuff, where they don't even know where they are yet. So, if you happen to be, diving somewhere and you run across an uncharted wreck, perchance, and it's got caseloads of champagne or whatever, you got to cut me in on the deal because I pointed you in the right direction. but there's just a lot of them around the Penetang area, which most boaters won't be going out that way. They'll be going up the east side, but around the Penetang area, it's kind of like where people come from all over the world to dive that area specifically because there's so many, you know, good wreck sites that are in one location. But you'll see them, I mean, you know, you'll see them all along. There are wrecks all along the way, like, you know, Bing Inlet, there's wrecks in there, and Parry Sound area, there's shipwrecks along there. If you go on the website, you can kind of go through and read through and get a good idea, what's down there. There's a lot, and that's only probably a fraction of what you see in the database. It's only a fraction. Those are the ones that we could research, that we could find about. Probably only a fraction of what's actually down there. Even around very close to some of the marinas, like the marina that I'm in, part of the pier is essentially made up of shipwrecks, right? And you don't have to go far from Midland or Penetang to find shipwrecks. There's visually with an eyesight of the towns, there's kind of wrecks out there. So some of them are a little tricky to find, and some of them are, they're kind of, there's not a lot left, but a lot of them, there's a lot of detail and stuff there. You want to be careful, you know, if you're diving, like going inside, anything like that. Advice would be that, you know, there are some dive services along the way, and if you really wanted to do some diving and serious exploring, you'd probably go to a dive service in Parry Sound, or if you're over at Tobermory, there's lots of them over there, and go out with a guide and go to a wreck site and have a good look around. But you can dinghy to wreck sites. Sometimes you'll be in anchorages where there's wrecks nearby, and you can dinghy over and snorkel and look down and check it all out and stuff like that. So there's lots and lots of that down there.
Great. I think we touched on this before, but specific safety contact information.
Yeah, again, it's on the website. I would advise you print that off. I mean, you probably want to have the number of the Ontario Boating League there. Coast Guard 16, everybody knows that. Star 16 on your cell phone. The Coast Guard has boats stationed around in different ports and stuff, so they have, you know, good access, and they have access to search and rescue as well, and like I mentioned, the OBL private service is out there. So I would advise you just to go and print that page off. You know, I personally keep it, you know, laminated and keep it up on the bridge, a little copy of that, just so that, you know, when you actually, you know, need a phone number, for OBL or something, you're not looking for it at the time. And, you know, I expect everybody in any event, they've got a bailout kit and they're prepared for something like that in the event that they were to run aground or have some kind of an accident. There's also a whole bunch of general safety information on that page as well about, you know, what to do if there's a fire and, you know, things like things that most people would know. But sometimes when you read stuff like that, it kind of sticks in your mind as a reminder so that when, you know, something were to happen, it kind of comes quicker that you go, you know, where the lights come on and you maybe react a little quicker than if it's something that you haven't brushed up on for a number of years type thing.
Okay, good. Great. In terms of charts for the area, how accurate are they?
Well, you know, they're accurate. The things that, you know, not everything is charted. You know, some of the harbors in the inland, you know, waterways and stuff are not charted. And, you know, certainly the main channels are accurate. The only thing you have to be aware of is the water heights. Water's back up now in Georgian Bay with all the rain and stuff we've had. It's pretty much, I think it's actually maybe even a little bit above chart datum. So that's good news. And you can go on the Notmar, www.notmar.gc.ca, which is the Government Canada website, and you can go on and look at any chart updates there. You can listen to the Notice of Mariners on your VHF and pick up any updates there. But most of the time, I mean, if you're in the small craft channel, you're going to be all right. You'll notice you're more likely to have you know, a little bit of silting or something like that in the Trent. But once you get up into Georgian Bay, it's you know, you don't have as much of this of a silting type of problem. It tends to be, you know, rock bottom or kind of rock mud. And if the overall water levels are good, then you're good in the channel anywhere. Again, the situation is more about weather and knowing where you are, that you are exactly where you think you are. And then as we talked about last time, you know, when you're going into anchorages and stuff like that, just having a good watch and looking ahead and watching your charts as well and looking ahead, you won't have any problems if you're careful.
Okay. How much wildlife can you expect to see in anchorages and just cruising in Georgian Bay?
Well, you will see, there's a chance you'll see wildlife. I mean, there's wildlife everywhere. I mean, the area that you're in, you know, bear, moose, deer, wolves are all in the area in common and much more than that. I mean, you know, there's everything you can imagine kind of thing. You probably will see less likely to see deer because they've kind of moved out of the evergreens and stuff and into the more swampy areas and stuff now. They're very unlikely to see wolves because they kind of follow the deer and they're around. If you were there in the wintertime, you'd see footprints all over the place, but they're very elusive and you're unlikely to see a wolf. Moose maybe if you're in an anchorage and there's a marshy basin or something to the anchorage and you're up in a remote area, or you're up in the hills somewhere and kind of looking down at a more of a swampy area and you're looking around, you could possibly see moose there. You know, when you live in the, like, I live kind of in central Ontario lakelands and stuff, so you know, we see them all the time. Hopefully you don't see one on the road coming through your windshield, right? but we see them all the time, and a little less deer this time of year, certainly in the spring, earlier in the spring and through the fall. They're out and about more, and you see them pretty heavily. Bears, you know, raccoons, things like that. If you've got food around and you leave it exposed, you're going to have a problem. I mean, if you left a barbecue on the shore, or you know, if you were camping on shore or something, and left food out or something like that, they're going to find it, right? So they're around. They stay out of your way unless there's something that attracts them, like food, you know. So you might see a bear. I mean, we've seen bears several times actually swimming across channels between islands, you know, where you'll see it actually, you know, see a bear maybe swimming across a channel from island to mainland or vice versa type thing, or island to island. They're out there.
The specific question I had written down was about rattlesnakes, but what kind of poisonous snakes do you have there and how abundant are they?
Yeah, well, the only poisonous snake in Ontario is the Massasauga rattler. And oddly enough, the only place that you find this rattlesnake is in the exact region that you're cruising. When you look out from Midland and you look out at Beausoleil Island, which is one of the park islands, Beausoleil Island has rattlesnakes, and from Beausoleil Island north of Parry Sound away, until you get up north of Parry Sound, has rattlesnakes. It's one of those things that you can't say suddenly here's where the territory ends and here's where they don't start. But by example, where we live, I'm over on a Trent feeder lake, which is more over on the Trent side. There's no rattlesnakes here, although it's the same kind of rugged, rocky country, right? But when you're over in the Georgian Bay area, because the habitat is conducive to it, with all the rocks and islands and stuff like that, they are there. They are protected by law and very sternly protected. The Massasauga rattler, just so people understand, it's kind of a non-aggressive rattlesnake. They're very elusive. They mainly hunt rodents at night. you're rare to see them in the day. They are around, maybe sunning on a rock or under rocks and stuff like that. Don't stick your hands into rocks and things like that when you don't know what's in there. The major risk is actually less with people and more so with pets. So, when you're walking around, you probably wouldn't even if there was one sitting there, you probably wouldn't even notice and see it. They blend in very well with the environment. And they tend to be, unless you get very close, because they're, very non-aggressive, they tend to just, shrink away or slither away. If you stepped on one or kicked one by accident or something like that, yeah, you could get a bite, right? Now, for humans, the poison in these rattlers is not as strong as what people may be, accustomed to down in the south. And you'd want to get to a hospital. And the major centers like Parry Sound, by example, has antidote in the hospital. And unless you were, already kind of maybe ill or something like that, you're unlikely to die. A human is likely to die from a Massasauga rattler bite, especially if you're going to get medical attention anyhow. You would call the Coast Guard in a situation like that, or find a park, get if there was a park ranger or something, if you're one of the parks and there was somebody from the Park Service nearby, and they would render assistance as well. The main thing is that I would advise people. I see people all the time, and their pets need exercise and they need to run and all that. But if you're on a on an island, a park island or something like that, in Anchorage, and your dog's running around the woods and running through the shore, they can pretty much find anything, right? I mean,
yep.
I know my dog would just be into it within no time, right? And so I would just be a little cautious of that you've got a good close eye on your pet and you're not just letting them, run around sniffing everything out around the rocks and all that. I know it's what pets do, but it's, if you had your dog bitten by a rattler, the problem is that you wouldn't get the same kind of attention that a human would. And so you're not going to have them airlift you out or people would try to help you. But if you're a long ways from everywhere and your dog's got bitten by a rattler, especially a small dog, that doesn't have the mass, then, your dog's in a heck of a lot of trouble, right? And,
yep.
You're just not going to get the same kind of attention that a human's going to get in an emergency situation like that. So I would just be very careful of your pets when they're on shore in those areas. They're not common. They're an endangered species. You spend enough time there and you will see one. You probably won't see one at all. But if you were looking, or if you're with a naturalist or something like that, a biologist, it wouldn't take, you'd be able to find one type thing. So they're protected. Don't kill one. The fines are major, major, major. If you get bitten, you just let it go and go get treatment. They're very elusive and they're not aggressive and they're very beneficial to the environment. So there're fewer of them all the time. It's kind of like their last kind of area that they're able to live in, and so it's kind of neat. If you get to see one, that's great. I mean, take a picture, just stay back a little ways, take a picture, walk the other direction, get out of the way. You'll never have a problem. If you walk up and kick it or poke at it or something like that, that's not the right thing to do.
But those are almost the same rules we use for alligators down here.
Yeah, I should mention also that you are likely to see other snakes. You'll see a lot of water snakes, things like that. All are non-poisonous. I mean, a lot of the snakes, there's some snakes that look a lot like the Massasauga rattler, but you know, if you go on the website, there's some pictures and stuff on there, and maybe take a look. But most of the snakes that you will see are all going to be, the non-poisonous snakes. Most commonly, you'll see water snakes. Water snakes sometimes even can look like they're aggressive, or, they'll swim towards you, or they'll even look like they're striking or whatever, but they really can't hurt you, even if one did get aggressive and bit at you or whatever, it's not going to do any damage, or there's no poison or anything like that. They're non-venomous. So you will see other snakes around more commonly than you would see a Massasauga, and especially the odd time in swampy areas, you might see a water snake swimming around or something like that. I just ignore them, and I even swim there when they're around, and they won't bother you.
We kind of touched on this with the talking about being bitten by a rattlesnake, but I take it that if you have a medical emergency, either the Coast Guard or the park rangers are the people to contact, and they'll make arrangements to get you evacuated?
Yeah. I mean, they would, regardless of where you were, a lot of the islands are not park islands, so, you wouldn't assume always. If you were on a park island hiking or something like Bosley, there's lots of park people around, and you're liable to see them even come into the anchorage and stuff with their boats and look around and stuff like that. But if you're somewhere remote and away from a park island, or you could be anywhere, you can always call the Coast Guard in an emergency, and they would make the determination whether they kind of took you out by boat, or they might advise you to proceed to, if you were somewhere like very close to Parry Sound, by example, or a major center, where there's a facility there, you would head right to that station, but they would advise you of that, and they'd take whatever action they needed to take to take care of you, and where you could get antidote.
Okay.
And you're not going to die. Unlike some other snakes that are more poisonous, you're not going to, get bitten and, take 10 steps and fall dead type thing. It's not like that. You've got some time there, and, all the medical facilities in the Coast Guard and everybody else involved in emergency services is kind of well aware of that, right? You wouldn't want to get bitten by a rattlesnake and just kind of shrug it off and go to sleep at night. Say, I'll worry about it tomorrow. That's not what you want to do.
Okay. And then I think we're down to our final question. And that is, if our listeners would like more detailed information, is there some contact point that you have that they can post that question on?
Yeah, I'm happy if they email our email address, which is info@boatinggeorgianbay.com. We'd be happy to pass along any information to specific marinas or anything we can help with, and we're happy to answer questions ourselves. So anything you send on to us, info@boatinggeorgianbay.com, we're not going to ignore it. We'll definitely respond to that, and either if we can't answer it, we'll find the answer for it, or we'll pass it along to the proper channel. I should also mention, I meant to mention earlier, we were talking about the weather and emergencies. When you're up in the North Channel, I think you've had Roy Eaton down there speaking at one of your
yep.
Rendezvous. And Roy does during July and August at 9 a.m. on Channel 771 on your VHF, does a Cruising Network radio show. And the
mm-hmm.
first thing that they do is ask if anybody, remotely is out there and has any kind of help they need or emergencies to report or stuff like that. So when you're in the north up there, there is that methodology too. Even if you're out of range of the channel, what happens is other boaters will pass the message along, until it gets back to them type thing.
One of the things that's happened is AGLCA and Roy have come to an agreement on, we're going to be broadcasting his broadcast as part of our blog talk radio. So
well, that's
we'll be
a good
on.
Idea. That's great. It's interesting for people to listen to, because it just, it's not just about emergencies. It's, other news and things that are going on in the area. And it's kind of a neat idea that somebody's actually doing that,
yep.
actually broadcasting by VHF. Also, you know, there is other things that you can get information off of. By example, you know, there's radio stations that offer marine weather and stuff like that too. So I don't want to pretend to say that the only place you can get information is the ones that I stated. There's other sources out there as well. I know Moose Radio does a marine broadcast. I believe Dock Radio does a marine broadcast. So there's other, I mean, you know, even if you're a VHF packed in or something, there'd be other ways to get information, you know, when you're cruising, right?
Sure. And I think that's it for today. Next week we're going to have, Janice is going to have to help me with this last name. John
Calisabetta.
Okay.
He's going to be talking about a little bit about New York Harbor, a little bit about the very closest part of the Hudson River to New York, and we're also going to go into the Staten Island area and talk about that.
Good. And then I'm going to do this as closing. Excuse me. We mentioned it a couple of times, but Mark's website is www.boatinggeorgianbay.com. So if you want more information on that, there's where you want to go. For those of you that want to listen to the prior broadcasts that we've had, including the prior one with Mark, if you go to www.greatloop.org, they're all archived there. And certainly for any non-members listening, we'd sure love to have you join. So you can also do that from the website. And with that, I believe we're done. Thank you very much, Mark.
We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. You're welcome. It was a pleasure. Bye now.
Bye-bye, all.